Canadian John Hutchison is a self-taught scientist who reports to have accidentally stumbled onto a collection of phenomena now known as the Hutchison effect during attempts to study the longitudinal waves of Tesla back in 1979. Some of the effects produced included levitation of heavy objects, metal samples that turned transparent, metals turned into jelly in the spontaneous fracturing of metals. The Hutchison effect has been well documented, film and on videotape, and has been witnessed many times by numerous credentialed scientists and engineers. His findings have been televised in the United States, Japan, and Canada. They've also piqued some interest from electrical engineering and aircraft companies, the Canadian Department of Defense, and the military. Our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM, John Hutchison. Hello, John. Welcome to the show again. How are you?
It's really great to be on with you.
Well, likewise. You know, you've been on with Art the last couple times, so this is going to be a good experience for me to be able to talk with you about that. Tell me a little bit about yourself, though. Just give me beyond the bio that I just read. Who is John Hutchison?
Well, George, I really have never figured that out yet. Really, to be honest, I don't know, but I keep working on it.
I know the feeling.
Well, I guess you call me a historical engineering type of character that likes gadgets and loves to experiment with old military surplus equipment, old forgotten types of machines that were built by Tesla, perhaps.
Was it Tesla that, in his work, that really got you going? I mean, was he your childhood idol, for example?
Well, one of my childhood idols that sort of spurned me on to develop some of the lost, forgotten technologies. And during the 1970s, I had that chance to replicate a lot of his equipment. And in doing so, after many years in building a machine shop up also, of course, to build some of the equipment, that I discovered the levitation effects, which kind of took me by surprise. That'd be roughly by 1979.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really think much of it, to be honest. I thought, well, isn't that kind of interesting?
Well, did you stumble into this, or were you trying to conduct some kind of experiment?
Well, I was basically trying to replicate a lot of Tesla's unique experiments by transmitting electrical energy without wires. And then what I'd do is turn the lights off and watch the effects of the coils themselves, along with the electrostatic generators that I also was duplicating, and would see these little miniature lightning storms within this area of mine. And one time I did that, and I heard this loud banging sound and thought, well, something really bad here, maybe some kind of danger, you know, with high voltage. So I turned the lights on and noticed this large piece of Bakelite material flipped over on its side, and I thought, oh, isn't that strange? So I think it was maybe a week later when I was doing the test that I actually started seeing things move around in the lab and thought, well, John, what? Been up too late working on the lathe or something like that. So a piece of metal went flying across the room and hit me on the shoulder one time. So how it started was that I always remember this. My landlord's son and I would stand at the door and toss little round balls of crumpled up tinfoil into the field, and it would hit the field and pop back out at us. And of course, the landlady, she got angry with us, saying you should be out there digging drains and that and stop playing around with that kind of stuff, although it caused other disturbances in the neighborhood. But then people started to hear about this, and they'd come down and start taking photographs and present them at the local ESP fair, as I recall. And then, after that, interesting people started coming around and talking to me about this type of stuff. And
word started getting around, didn't it?
Oh, it sure did, George. It sure did. I was some very interesting folks interviewed me and talked with me, and then engineers and folks started coming out and wanted to see demonstrations, which it did do, because the effects, as I fine-tuned the equipment more and more, these effects turned quite major and were documented on Super 8 mm film. So, and also photography at the time, because video recorders and that weren't really popular.
That's right.
So as time went on, my business partners at that time, who convinced me that what I was doing was quite important, decided to invite the U.S. government up and Los Alamos National Laboratories back in 1983, where we did a four-month test program.
Now, what did you do to kind of induce them to come up and look? Because did you have to send them some of the film? I mean, because I would guess at first hand they'd go, right, sure.
Well, I didn't go. I was sort of, a lone wolf at the time, living in what call North Vancouver, where it's mostly forest. So these folks, they went to the Pentagon and presented the tape to the people there. And, of course, I'm told a story after the fact. I always remember this, that one general there, he said that, you can't show that nonsense. And this is third-party information, by the way. You can't show that nonsense in here. And then one other general wanted to go directly to the president, who was Reagan at the time. So a decision was met there, as I understand it. And then, he's one of your guests, Colonel Alexander.
Oh, yeah, John. Yeah.
Yes, John Alexander came and group from Los Alamos. Lab was set up for 4 months, and unfortunately, I don't think there was anything on videotape. So we fired up the equipment, and there's all these weird effects happening, and I always remember John marking the floor with masking tape for X's for any kind of standing waves.
Well, I got to tell you, I've been looking at your videos for the past couple days on your website, and I've been trying to figure out, okay, there's got to be a trick here. There's got to be something, and I can't see it, John. I can't see. Yeah, if I have to take the skeptic's eye for a moment, I can't see how you could rig this up to do that. And you've answered a question that I was going to ask you on your website about something that looks like a string. It's not a string. It's more of an electrical wire, isn't it?
Well, that's a high voltage wire with a take up loop. That's something that is doing for Fox Television in around 2000, 2001, and I captured it on a webcam into my poor old laptop computer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the work you'd find. I was trying to combine T. Townsend Brown's work with some of the Tesla effects here and Hutchison effects, but with kind of poor results, as you can see. So I had to cheat and use a high voltage line to the little toy flying saucer, which made it jump around quite a bit. And for the take-up coil, I didn't want any high voltage hitting any of the equipment here and starting a fire.
Can you control these objects, or do they just go all over the place?
Well, I used to, towards the, okay, stepping back in time, 1987, 89, I was really in control of the effects. Prior to that, the effects were maybe several per day. And during the Canadian government test, we had some major effects happen, but they still have that classified, and I'm still trying to get the tapes from them. That was 1986. But as time progressed on and I studied and learned more, of course, the effects happened a lot more per hour. So I'd have maybe, anywhere from 5, 6 to 7 major effects happening per hour, which was caught on prime video. That have stainless steel bars turning mm-hmm. into like rubbery things that would turn themselves into knots, or other metals converting themselves into other materials. Sometimes we even get wood inside blocks of metal, and which is hard to believe. And when the Canadian government analyzed the Super 8 mm film, they found that some of the metal samples turned transparent, which is quite unique. I had never seen that effect myself. I just read it in the report that my friend there tried to get all the information from the Canadian government, Chuck Cook. And basically, it was a matter of national security, and I got parts of the report, but not the videos.
Have you ever been, pulled into a laboratory, a governmental laboratory, and locked up, and they say, all right, now keep doing this for us and work on this?
George, I wouldn't go for anything like that. No, I've never been approached in that kind of way. The military-industrial complex, sort of, when they do, like, say we do a TV show, excuse me, they'll say it's PK, or if the report says PK, except for the Canadian government report doesn't say PK. So it's a matter of, when they say that on TV. It's a matter of protecting me and also protecting them.
Let's go back, John. Tell us a little bit about the work of Tesla as it related to what you were doing, because like you, he has always fascinated me with what he had done. Unfortunately, he was never able to really finish the big job that he had wanted, and then he died. And then I think I'm told that the FBI has taken his files when he died, and they're gone. His research, it's all gone. Have you heard that?
Yes, I heard that. I've actually been approached by cousins and that actually knew him some years ago looking for some of the missing papers. One was a banker down in San Francisco. Another person up here in Canada who actually knew Tesla personally, Thomas Lee Richardson, who had a lot of his documentation. But unfortunately, when Thomas Lee Richardson went ill, he was put in a home and all the stuff was then taken up by the Canadian government here. And sent, we found out later, just some years ago, was sent overseas to some relatives. But my interest in Tesla was, here's this person. I didn't have very much information about him, but I've always been intrigued by machinery, no matter what it is, well-made machines. So I started reading about him, then digging around for information. There was not much around in those days, so I heard bits and pieces, you know, and then, what is a Tesla coil? And then I went into studying how he actually would make these machines, and then I would go to the scrapyards and actually try and find the original wires, because I like to make things back to the original time period as much as I can. So I was doing this rather on a fanatic kind of power, like energy there abundant to, let's say, do 10,000 turns on a spool of wire by hand without a lathe or anything. That's what kind of determination I had, so I started replicating the machines. I had all the scrapyard people looking for old relics and stuff actually going back to the 1880s that they would find and actually say, well, here, John, we found this for you. It's an old gauge, an old motor. So I built up a massive collection of artifacts and also made pieces that was as accurate as I could, you know, basically get into with Tesla.
So did you get close?
Oh, very close as possible. I went right into getting the original wire from the scrapyards and doing exactly what Tesla said, because he did publish a book by
Have other scientists, John, though, tried to duplicate what you are doing and what Tesla had done with any success at all?
Well, I know that there's a lot of people doing research into Tesla's work and have come up with some very interesting results, such as Richard Hull, who found that he can actually make things invisible himself. And some prominent U.S. scientists there have come up with what they call charge cluster technology from Tesla's research. With the anti-gravitational effects, and now all of this happens away from the machinery at a distance up to perhaps 300 feet, all I can tell you is that I'm not sure, but there was a TV program in 2001 where Lockheed Martin Skunk Works said they maybe have developed something. That's all I know, like bits and pieces of the actual levitations. Some people say, yes, we have developed it. And others say, well, no, it's still being studied. So I can't really be honest and say it's been replicated fully. Unless, you know, it's been brought to my attention, perhaps in Area 51, they're working on this technology.
All right, give us a full definition of the Hutchison effect, of course.
George, it's like a Pandora's box, I was told once. When you have the Hutchison effect, it's levitation, transmitting metals into complex alloys, taking things and causing, like, shields of white light, multicolored lights, bending and shaping of metals, turning metals transparent, getting other metals within the metal itself, blocks of wood and sawdust within the metal samples that were tested at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, and also in University of Toronto, I should say. It's been studied quite a bit, and McDonnell Douglas Aerospace Corporation, they wanted to try and get funding to present it out there as basically a new propulsion source.
What's the heaviest object, John, that you've been able to levitate?
Well, in this particular incident, it was about a 1,500-pound transformer was levitated by my machinery, but by not me, but by the other team that I was working with, Boeing Aerospace Corporation, who managed to actually videotape a transformer lifting off a platform. However, I don't have that video, so that is the heaviest known thing to be lifted.
How high did it go?
I'm not too certain. I'm not told how high it went. They refer to it as the transformer that took off, because this is a new team with Boeing. Prior to that, I had another team, so we had a lot of disputes between us at the time, and I was invited by Germany and Austria to go over there and study the Hutchison effect with all the lab equipment. So when I was not in my lab, these tests were done, and this is really getting into a, how can you say it, George, a very involved kind of X-file kind of thing, because the lab was then seized by the feds. And this is when I was in Germany, and they tried to keep it a secret, but it made the front page of the Vancouver Sun newspapers.
They seized it?
They seized the lab. It was destined for Germany, paid for by Germany and Austria. And all the shipping and packing and the crates and that of everything. But, however, unfortunately, the Canadian government literally walked over a BC Supreme Court order and took the lab. And tried to actually hide it under the Alex Fraser Bridge, but trying to be very secretive about it. But the newspapers found out about the whole thing and presented it on front page news.
John, the object that you've got on your website that is levitating, the small toy UFO-looking object,
mm-hmm.
and it wiggles all over the place. Now, explain to us, and we're gonna run into the break here, so we might not have time, but what did you do to get that to start moving? Did you bombard it with the electromagnetic waves? What did you do?
Oh, basically, I was bombarding it with electromagnetism, lots of electromagnetism. And then, of course, I then applied power. This is the toy's UFO?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was loaded up with about 20 to 30,000 volts direct current with a thin wire. Then I started hitting it with 24, 21 centimeters down to 455 kilohertz wavelengths. And then it started to bounce in that field, but I needed the direct connect to it to cause it to move around. However,
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Prior to that, I was able to demonstrate it without wire and high voltage to Fox TV, which aired as Ghost, Best Evidence Caught on Tape. And they presented that. And that was in 2000. The reason that I kind of messed up here and not be able to levitate anything is basically I'm an avid collector of military surplus, which sort of interrupted the whole field structure.
All right, when we come back, John, I want to ask you what would happen had a human being had that kind of electromagnetic power shot right at them. Would they levitate or would they merely disintegrate? Back in a moment. John, if you are able to use the same amount of voltage that you use to levitate the small UFO and aimed it at a human being, would he levitate or would you fry the guy?
Well, George, he would be fried cookies. This is normally not the Hutchison effect, the energy directed to that little UFO. That's a direct connected wire.
All right.
But the fields are, how can I put it for you now? The fields, something else happens at a distance from the equipment. In the older experiments, you'd have something levitate or float in the air, or just simply hover, or turn into some kind of gelification of the metals, but no directed connections underneath.
Okay. When the metals, for example, gelified, did they come back to their original shape, or was that it? They were just a blob of whatever?
They were a big, massive blob of materials that were, look, almost incomprehensible and actually surrealistic. And then, of course, they'd be analyzed and tested and see what actually happened to them. And they found that some of these samples seemed to be altered in time, according to the Max Planck Group in Germany.
Well, explain that.
It's like it's continuously changing the material itself. the magnetic structure, the grain structure, keeps changing with time. This is this verbal, of course, from the Max Planck Institute in Germany, but they were fascinated by the effects. And these were small test samples. Like some of those samples are 3-inch diameter bars that are maybe 20 inches long of stainless steel or aluminium. I just say aluminium because I can't say aluminum.
So, it's almost like the material's alive if it continues to change.
To see it on videotape is quite amazing, George. It looks alive. It really does. And I have many, like, but roughly 10 hours of this kind of stuff.
John, this reminds me, do you remember the 1947 Roswell case? And there were witnesses who said that they saw pieces of metal when their fathers brought them home. And you could, like, crunch it up, and then it would come right back to its original shape. This seems a little bit like that. That it has some kind of special technology to it that in your case, made these things out of jelly. But I wonder if we're talking about alien technology that you or Tesla has been able to tap into.
Good question, George. Sometimes I feel like an alien out there. I think a lot of people look at me like an alien. I think they did so with Tesla, too. But he was a brilliant scientist. And I just sort of accept who I am and get myself into these mischievous situations, I guess. But I enjoy doing all that for all those years and wouldn't change any of it for all the tea in China.
Well, you've been doing a lot of this for a long time now, more than 20 years. And is the equipment that you've got any better than it used to be? I know a long time ago some of your equipment was confiscated. Did that nullify the ability for you to do more experiments? I mean, what happened after that?
Well, what happened after the incident in 1990, when they confiscated the entire lab, like it was basically the weight of it alone was around 22 to 25 tons.
That's a lot of equipment.
That is a heck of a lot of equipment. It also included some machine tools and all the Tesla coils and high voltage equipment. When that was gone, and when I returned to Canada here, I basically decided that I had some stuff I wanted to sell, get rid of. Luckily, all the files and videos were saved because they were in another location. Like, I have a cubic yard of videos and a cubic yard of documentation, approximately, plus all the metal samples, which basically fills an oil drum.
They didn't get everything?
No, they didn't get any of that stuff. So I was left with a gun collection, which I sold off. And some test equipment, which I sold off. I just determined, well, what's the point of staying in this country, Canada, because I never liked the place at first. Well, I better not say that. I dreamed of going to California and live there. But what happened then, I kind of got nullified and just wanted to return to Europe and forget about everything. Then the Japanese got interested in what I was doing and suggested that I go on a lecture tour in Japan, which I did do in 1993, 94, 95. And I think one of the most energetic lecture tours probably was 94.
Where did you go? All over the country? The world?
All over the country. They were just lecture tours every day in every city. Our home base was Hiroshima City.
Who listened?
Everybody. They had the main television station, TV Asahi, or JOGM TV, the affiliate to it, covered us for a half hour on the news service. Then they started publishing magazines and books on us. I was with my ex, Sarah Yin. She's a filmmaker, and they liked her, too, and they were traveling around. And the same thing happened in 95. Brian O'Leary then was with me, and we did our lecture tours. He's an astronaut friend of mine who's...
Oh, yeah, he's been on the program before.
Really super nice guy, and yeah. We have a lot of laughs when we're together, and we really worked hard for our hosts over in Japan, and it was just unbelievable. It's like Alice in Wonderland, the way they treat you and what happened over there. Also down in the U.S. too, when I gave my lecture in Denver, Colorado.
Well, the Japanese, John, are good at duplicating American know-how. I'm wondering if they picked up or tapped into you and they're doing this now.
I can't answer that honestly. I know that my host there in Japan made two Tesla coils in this building in Hiroshima City and is trying to get results. I thought, well, you're not going to get results like that. You don't use two Tesla coils. It's a maze of equipment that you use to try and duplicate these effects.
Now, the Tesla coil, though, itself, it's simple in nature, isn't it?
Oh, it's an open-air transformer. It's so simple, it's incredible that anybody can really make one, even from stuff from a dumpster if they're desperate. It resonates a voltage on a, what they call a secondary to a primary, which amplifies the energy to super high voltages.
But if you don't know what you're doing, I mean, you could kill yourself with this kind of equipment, can't you?
Oh, you could kill yourself big time. I remember dealing with roughly like 100,000 volts DC at 5,000 joules power discharge, which sounded like a cannon going off.
Oh, my God. There's so, nothing left of you.
Nothing left. And I was using these huge, gigantic X-ray transformers, the one that was levitated by the other group from Boeing. That you're dealing with up to 400,000 volts.
I've got to ask you this. Of course, I'm going to go way back to the pyramids, and then I want to talk to you about Coral Castle and a fellow by the name of Edward Leeds Skolnin. But do you think the Egyptians might have had some kind of technology like this?
I've been approached by many people with that question. How can I answer it? I honestly don't know. Well, I was in Egypt, actually, and saw the pyramids firsthand, and I just shook my head. I said, how could they ever do that with ropes?
Yeah.
I mean, I can understand maybe, you know, people pulling those things up and building these massive structures, and Karnak and all these places. Then I thought, well, maybe there was some form of acoustic levitation that could do it. Then I thought, I don't know, this... Like, it's sort of like a mystery. And why isn't there evidence of, let's say, equipment that would generate this kind of stuff? Although they have Egyptian batteries and diagrams and stuff that resemble electrical circuits. But
if one could do the Hutchison effect during the days of the pyramids, could they have moved blocks that way?
Yes, if they had the equipment and if they were persevered and weren't interrupted, they most likely could do it.
Now, with the anti-gravity properties of whatever you're moving, I mean, could you, like, with a finger, just, like, push it into place?
You could push it into place, or simply blow on it and then move it into place.
My God, just like that?
Just like, it's zero gravity around the objects, George. And you could have, let's say, 5 tons and just put your little finger on it, and it would just float across. You'd have to overcome a little bit of inertia, but just start floating on its own.
If they didn't have the technology, it's very possible, though, that a fellow by the name of Edward Leeds Skolnin, who lived in Florida and built a facility called the Coral Castle, huge structures, a frail man, all by himself, knew some kind of technology, he might have been using this, too.
I wonder. I often wondered about Coral Castle. I studied every angle about it, and it just keeps coming up as a mystery. Do you think maybe, perhaps, he has some PK ability, which seems to exist with certain individuals, or some unique way of using some machinery to perhaps levitate something like that? I mean, it's just absolutely incredible what he did for Coral Castle and building that huge complex. And actually getting the coral itself was quite unique.
What are you doing now? I mean, are you working for industry, or are you still on your own? What's happening to John Hutchison?
Right now, I seem to be more of a consultant to TV people. I just finished working on Ark of the Covenant for Blue Book Films.
Now, we've got a picture of your design of the Ark on our website that you're so gracious to allow us to take from you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. And tell me a little bit about that, because the Ark itself, too, had some interesting properties to it, didn't it?
It had a lot of energy to it. I was contacted by Blue Book Films. Excuse me there, George, for coughing like that. I had to do that to clear my throat. So
shame on you, John.
Yeah, good heavens, I know. Sorry about that. Good grief. I should know.
10 million people just heard you cough.
Oh, good grief. Oh, now I'm turning red. Everything around me is getting warm here, George. Good grief.
Yeah, that's because you're shooting magnetic volts at yourself, probably.
Well, I'm sitting here with my hands on the lathe, and now my fingers are greasy. But I was contacted by Blue Book Films back in the summer of last year on the idea of building the Ark of the Covenant. And I said, sure, I'd be happy to do that. And our producer, He still owes us a bit of money, by the way, if you're listening. Okay. Bruce, come on, behave yourself out there. Okay, sorry about that. Anyway, we had a lot of fun doing the project. And basically, there's two arcs. There's my little arc here that I built to test inside my lab here. Then there's a larger arc just a half a mile away sitting at a woodworking shop made out of acacia wood, which is full-scale, full-sized arc that we use.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, in the last months of filming, we did a major test in a metal supermarket in Richmond, British Columbia. Much to our surprise, and much to the proprietor's surprise, who gave us the space during the holiday season, he had looks of terror of Indiana Jones returning. There was all this white light coming off the plastic cherubim that was sent from the UK to be put on top of this massive ark. And these things were styrofoam painted with gold paint. Corinne, my lady, she painted the cherubims, and they stand about 22 inches high. We're mounted on top of this gigantic acacia wood arc.
And I think we can see that on the website, right?
That one there is a baby
that's
arc.
That's the small one, right?
That's
a small one. But a duplicate of what the big one looks like?
Except the cherubim looked more like angels. Mine looked like vultures, according to my friend Alexander. But it worked for the tests here, where we're doing a lot of high-voltage tests with lemon juice and vinegar, and which we thought, because of being a voltaic pile, that maybe they use that kind of method to power the arc. Then we used electrostatics, so we applied electrostatics to it and got some extremely interesting high-voltage capacitance out of it. And then, of course, we tried some of my crystalline material on the plates themselves, and it produced a half a volt. But the large arc, you see, what we did was take it to this metal supermarket, and I had a Tesla call because I wanted to replicate the desert conditions, let's say, in Egypt.
At the time, right?
At the time, George. So here I am with my Tesla call, making it basically on the run, as we're gathering stuff from Rona and setting up and firing up this Tesla coil. So what happened was there's no sparks coming off the coil itself. It induced a high frequency, which seemed to collect on these two cherubims on top of the arc, which started to turn where there was cracks through the paint. It would actually turn white. I guess you'd call it carbonization.
Yes.
And then the sparks started to happen all around the feet. And between the two big cherubs and the proprietor of the metal supermarkets, looked like he's looking at Indiana Jones, was kind of backing up. And as this progressed along, Rudy, our film and guy and director, just kept filming all the time. I said, Rudy, good grief. You know, something's happening here that shouldn't be happening. No, he said, this is what we want. I said, well, what do you want me to do? Turn off the power? No, turn it up. So, okay, I'll turn it up. I turned the variac up and up went the voltage and these things burst into flames of black smoke and exploded, and Rudy is still filming, and then, you know, the place is getting full of smoke. It's a major warehouse, 30-foot ceiling, and the proprietor is back against the door there, and he asks Corinne there to get the fire extinguisher, and she says, I don't know how to use it, you know, so, anyway, he used to pull the pin, okay, she pulled the pin and starts shot the fire extinguisher at the cherubim, and one went sailing across the room like a fireball disappearing in the metal and black smoke, and the other one went flying off down by the Tesla coil where I backed and ran away, and Rudy was filming everything, and I grabbed Corinne and gave her a big hug, and we did what the film people wanted, and achieved the goal of producing lots of energy. And, of course, the manager of the metal supermarket, he said, well, you're doing this kind of stuff, you got to go somewhere else.
Yeah, please get out of here. Do you think the ARC was a battery, a huge battery?
I think it was basically, George, a huge, gigantic electrostatic battery. And one of my favorite heroes I like to study also is Ben Franklin and his experiments with electrostatics.
There's a former NASA scientist, Charles Yost, has done a lot of research into EMF effects. Did you ever do work like that?
All types of work with everything I could think of with electromagnetic pulses and all that neat stuff. Oh, yes, I've been there and done it.
When do you think John, that some corporation will really start to market this for a propulsion system?
I honestly think, and I kind of explained that before, though, and I can't tell you for sure, but I feel that perhaps in Area 51 or some one of the main Air Force bases, they are indeed working on the technology right now. I know that the stealth bomber has electrostatic shield around it to help disperse the X-rays.
Well, and you mentioned Boeing, and I'm told that Boeing has been working on anti-gravity machines for a couple of years now, at least.
Oh, well, I guess they'll be working on it because I'm unaware of that, George.
John, have you been published anywhere? Have any of the mainstream scientific journals done any stories on you? I know you were in After Dark a few years ago, one of our publications, but I mean in terms of mainstream publications.
Good question. I've been featured in Nick Cook's book, The Hunt for Zero Point. He works
yes.
with Jane's Defense Weekly.
Right.
And some independent scientists have published scientific data that I have here. So what I'm trying to say, George, is that there's a lot of stuff out there that goes on that I become aware of later. I get a book in the mail and I'm featured in the book, or I find some documentation that's mailed to me and, oh, I didn't know that was existing. As far as scientific data, that's sort of being left to my colleague George Hathaway in Toronto, who's publishing a book on yours truly with all the scientific data. And there's also a lot of other data, of course, from the Canadian government and also the Max Planck Group in Germany. So there's a lot of stuff out there that's being put together, and I guess because they get more popular with the TV shows, I don't know. But it's coming together. So the book on yours truly should be out, I would think, beginning of next year sometime.
Have you ever been involved in any special black ops programs or anything like that?
Kind of.
Kind of.
Kind of.
Can you talk about it?
Well, yes. I mean, the visit to me here in 1983 is sort of a black ops thing, and if it went through, everybody wanted to go through, the colonel, the Los Alamos team, except one man didn't really want it to go through. And he just classified it and said, well, no, you're not making the scientific community today, John. So the team was very upset over that, plus the colonel, who got even in a way by calling in McDonnell Douglas to do an unclassified report, but labeling it as mostly PK. So then I got involved later on after I gave a television demonstration of it, the Canadian government came down, and mostly they're all black ops. They only stayed one day, filmed everything, then disappeared again. So we're actually right now trying to work on getting those videos back. But they deny ever being out here. However, I had a lot of correspondence with them. Dr. Kuhn of DSTI, and he's the Director of Scientific Technical Intelligence Agency in Canada. So Canada does have its own little black ops operation, I guess you'd say. So what has happened really, George, I think, is that a lot of people felt, and I've told us, that we showed them everything and they went off into the unknown areas there and started to work on it. Because we're always free and open with the research to all the teams that used to come and go. We've given out, at least I estimate, perhaps, in those 10 years, roughly about 750 demonstrations.
Have you ever had your life threatened, John?
No. Nobody wanted to knock me off or throw rotten apples at me yet. No, nothing like that.
Well, knock on wood, huh?
If I could find it in here. No, nothing, no.
Of the work that you've done with the Hutchison effect, which levitation, of course, just is to me, that's something else, but also turning some of these metal samples transparent and then into jelly, of course, are equally astonishing because they change the properties of what those metals are. But of all the things that you've done, is there one there that even you continue to say was the most exciting of everything you did?
I think the time was so many events so different and unique, like everything lifting off at one time. I would have to say perhaps seeing a 3-inch diameter stainless steel bar by 20 inches long turning around like a snake was pretty impressive. And the reason I'm hedging on the fence about that is because the invisibility factor appeared again with the whole building turning invisible, which sounds like a raving lunatic basically saying something to you like that, but it was confirmed by a real estate agent back in the 1988, 89, who actually was kind of angry because we had to get the lab insured. This is the new group from Boeing. And this agent came around. He said he was there. There was no building here. He saw no building. And we asked him over and over again, were you on the right street? There's an 88 food market with big red letters. Yes, I was here, he said, but there was just an empty lot. So my team, myself, and I were scratching our heads just thinking, well, is it possible again? It seems to be confirmed by the Canadian government analysis of the tape that things turn transparent where you can see through them. Is it possible that the whole building turned transparent? I don't know. I can't. How can I prove it? Something like that. But it was quite a dramatic thing for all of us because the insurance guys thought we're crazy.
Well, it is difficult to prove something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for a whole building, that is, unless it was photographed and you had cameras set up and a scientific team, which normally that's the way we do things, but in this particular case, there wasn't that, there's no videos or video cameras or equipment around or scientists. So, one impressive thing about it, though, George, is that it seems to affect background radiation, where the field, when it's turned on, when it's not levitating or transforming metals, seems to repel the background radiation a bit to several counts per minute.
Hmm.
To your normal 15 counts per minute. So I took my Geiger counter out and calibrated it, make sure it was working, and then I would walk away from the lab, leaving it running on its own, walk out, and the counts would start picking up again to 15, roughly 15, give or take. And then when I went back in the area, it was do that. And another major incident was a shaking telephone pole. That was kind of dramatic. I mean, we've done so many things during those 10 years. It's like, here's a shaking telephone pole that comes out of nowhere. And I was alone. I can't prove it. But this pole was going back and forth, and my instinct was some trucker, some vehicle got caught in a guy wire trying to back out of something here and doesn't realize he's taking the whole telephone pole around with him. And there's a bunch of people out there looking at it. I went out and looked, and I saw no traffic or anything there, and I thought it can't be. And the wires coming into the building were starting to do almost like a skipping rope effect. So I said, no way, this is silly. And I slammed the main breakers and all the machines went down and the pole stopped shaking. Again, I can't prove it with videos or witnesses unless I went back and tried to trace all the witnesses in the building next to me there. But
can this be used as a weapon, John?
As an e-weapon, yes. It can be used as a weapon, I'm sure.
Now, I've always heard that the United States had that already. Is that possible?
Yes, they have some types of artillery shells with RF that if you shoot these things out of a cannon, they send out an RF energy that knocks out sensitive electronics. Also, they have a unit that will transmit out a very powerful electromagnetic pulse, which knocks out sensitive electronics, too. I think the unit's mobile. It has a range of about, I think about 1,000 feet, maybe more now.
Now, have you been able to duplicate any of the equipment that was confiscated from you in the 80s?
Well, I was sorry, George. You know, I was following a lot of the tech by going on the measurements I did and was able to replicate a lot of the fields that were used at that time. So during 2000, I was able to literally levitate things up to the ceiling, which I thought was kind of impressive. However, the main problem there was being in an apartment, which I shouldn't be, because the incident back with the lab being taken away, I didn't have any interest. And then, of course, coming back here, I started gaining interest in 93, rebuilding everything within an apartment, which is quite an engineering feat unto itself. But it would affect several square blocks of area here, and the police would show up. And during a very special documentary done by Griffin Film Productions, which is about a half hour long for Discovery Channel International, it's airing in Canada already right now, actually starring Colonel Alexander and Nick Cook.
And you're, really?
Yeah, well, yeah. It's a real special documentary where Peter Putkammer goes into great detail in the Hutchison effect. It's called Beyond Invention. And when we're doing some experiments here trying to levitate something, which really didn't happen. However, we did get the little saucer on the string moving around a little bit. The neighbor above me had to be taken away later by the police.
What happened to him?
We don't know. He was just screaming and yelling that he's got technology down there in film crews. The other people were saying, I was hearing strange noises in my apartment. What were you doing? We know you, kind of thing. So I guess from the TLC TV shows. And I said, I was going to come around and punch your lights out. And I said, well, sorry about that, but they had a sense of humor at least. And other people said, well, my ornaments started falling off in the building. So I mentioned a few situations to Peter there to maybe call up the people for witnesses, which he did do. And a friend of mine, I think she didn't want to go on to the TV. So anyhow, that kind of problem exists. I managed to get a little bit of it on video when they did come the first time I tried the whole experiment, where I had the major levitation for Fox TV, and they came full force, and then I just turned everything off and laid quiet. Then the other time when Miramax Motion Pictures and Fox were here, the problem started. So, and then up to 2003, did we do the Griffin films then? I think so, or 2002. So that time, I just thought now it's not worth it. The effects actually aren't that good because I have a tendency to collect things. I can't turn down a good piece of junk like military surplus stuff. It's one of those things. I must have been born an old pirate or something. I'm not sure, George.
You had some interest from Bill Clinton in those days, didn't you?
Oh, I got yeah, that's kind of funny. That was going back to 97.
Tell me what happened.
A lot of guys. I had a U.S. congressman here, too. Ex-congressman Berkeley Bedell, who visited me here personally. And with Clinton, Bill Clinton, he sent me these greeting cards. And actually two of them. And I remember opening my mailbox and thinking, oh, the White House. And I thought, oh, Norman Baker, the fellow that makes kombucha tea down in Pacific Palisades, a friend of mine, because he calls his house the White House. So I thought, well, I guess this Norman Baker is having fun here. And then I opened up the thing, and it's real. It's a real notation, basically saying that my anniversary. And I'm thinking, okay, it's real, so why would it come to me? It didn't seem to state any message except that congratulations on my anniversary. And then it happened again. A second note came within some months' time, oddly enough, directly from the White House, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, they know you.
I think so. I mean, I was getting a heavy correspondence from Colonel North. And, well, I got a collection of letters from these folks that sent it. I always keep the envelopes and the original letter and put it into a sealed container, and then I make a photocopy of it, of course, to show and tell and brag
sure.
to people about it.
Have you always been good technically, even when you were a kid?
Oh, I was into everything, and I was getting into trouble. Like, yeah, I used to make, believe it or not, George, I used to make trinitroglycerine in my mother's refrigerator.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
drink it accidentally?
Like taking it outside in the backyard and laying it off, and the neighbors saying we thought the furnace blew up problems.
Oh, God.
I know, and I had a spark gap transmitter. I couldn't resist that on top of my father's roof. It was basically an induction coil thing that put out like 17,000 volts, and it was heavy spark gaps. And eventually, 1965, the Vancouver newspapers found out, and CBC found out about all this crazy guy in North Vancouver doing these balloon experiments with hydrogen where these things would take off in the air covered in tinfoil, which actually started a UFO invasion fear in Vancouver City. And it's written up in the newspaper. So they came, the reporters came around and then did my story. And I thought, oh, good, my goodness, you know, I thought, felt like a big shot, you know, kind of thing with all these reporters and that, and giving interviews on CBC. And I always remember that. I often wonder, good grief, John, I, you know, thinking back to myself, I didn't, luckily I didn't blow myself up the whole house. But
why haven't you sold your technology? You could have made millions.
Well, it was, I was always told that this kind of technology can't really, the only way you can possibly do anything is with a military-industrial complex. The other supporter who promises to support me all the time owns his own country, Prince Liechtenstein, who I've been in contact with for 13 years by letters, always promising to sponsor me, but never anything. I even sent him a metal sample to add to his private art collection, which he...
Is he the prince of that little tiny country called Liechtenstein?
Yeah, he's the owner of it, or the...
The owner, yeah.
Well, kind of, that's what he's...
he's got the key.
He's got the key, he's the main fellow, and I've been in correspondence with him since 1989 when I was in Germany, up to right now.
That's 15 years, and he hasn't popped for anything yet?
Nothing, although his offer to my colleague George Hathaway was some years ago where I would move back to Toronto, Canada, and set up the lab. But I declined because, George, I really like my freedom. That's one of the drawbacks with me, too. I got my own drawbacks, of course. I could have been probably very rich if I said, sure, I'd love to walk right up to your door there, you know, and let's say I could work here at the Defense Department or whatever and do all this stuff for you. But I don't know. There's, for me, working 9 to 5, I'm kind of a rogue kind of character because I get sidetracked. I want to, let's say I'll concentrate on researching this out, and then I see a piece of military surplus, and I want to research that out. So I sort of go from that to...
One project to another.
Yeah, so I've never...
Yeah.
I think it's a creative energy.
Well, that happens a lot. A lot of people that are creative like you, John, sometimes don't even finish a project because they're so anxious to start the second one.
That's happened to me a few times.
See, you need to surround yourself with somebody who is a nuts and bolts person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you come up with these great ideas and things, and you want to go off to the next project, you got to have someone complete these things for you.
Basically, yes. I've been trying to get the word out. The congressman friend of mine, Berkeley Bedell, he was highly interested in my research and wanted to try and, like a lot of people are right, even right now, are trying to get some way of marketing a small power cell of mine. It's just basically an energy scavenging cell where it takes any kind of energy, heat, gravimetric, a tiny bit of zero point, and makes a small amount of direct current. But they're not powerful enough to drive anything, really. Some of the other models were, but are not mine because they were funded by a German team and also the Japanese teams who have them in Hiroshima City and also in Munich. But I'm trying to market something like a tricorder because these crystals tend to also, the crystal cells, register environmental energies and have actually been used in detection of oil. Pinnacle Oil International.
So that's just what they need to find right about now with record gasoline prices, huh?
I know, George. I'm really surprised that there hasn't been a Manhattan-style project on zero-point energy.
I know, and it is, I don't know, concerning that they haven't gone forward with something like that. I just don't know if they will. John, what was it like years ago when you turned on the old electromagnetic apparatus and all of a sudden these objects started floating around? It must have been mind-boggling.
Well, George, in the very beginning of that, it was rather fascinating. And we used to stand there with crumpled up tinfoil balls tossing it in the field. Things would pop back out as... And, you know, I was very green. I didn't, you know, think anything much of it until people started coming around and taking photographs and then presenting these at an ESP fair. And then other people would come around and start interviewing me. And this was then taken off basically to the U.S. Department of Defense, where they decided to come and investigate it.
I wonder if you would have won science fairs if you had done this as a kid, if they would have understood.
Hmm. could just somehow have it mobile, it would have been fantastic. Or even now, in this day and age, with all the influx of television people to give these demonstrations.
Are you going to continue the research, or it sounds like you're moving more in the direction of media and knowledge of this as opposed to actually doing it?
It appears that way, George. It seems that I'm being approached for more of a consultant in this area.
Do you prefer that?
It's kind of fun, although I want to really move someday, and my preferred place would be Southern California and set up a lab again and do these things actually for television.
Well, you know, we were talking the hour before you came on about Mr. Wizard. Do you remember him?
Yeah, Mr. Wizard. They called me Tom Swift back in 65. Yeah.
Did they?
Oh, good heavens, yes. They said Tom Swift in North Vancouver's at it again.
I believe it.
Oh, it's kind of funny, the story they did back then. But
well, tell me one.
Oh, about the invasion of the UFOs that that was happening in Vancouver City?
Absolutely. Tell
oh,
me the
heavens.
Story.
The military is thinking, what's all these radar blips going on here? It's written in the paper. And I'm just generating hydrogen gas from aluminum strips and ordinary lye and having fun setting these things off in the air. And I was doing it again and again and again. And, of course, I'd coat these things with tin foil so they can really shine in the bright sky with the sun. You can see them floating around like little speckling bright sparks or something way up there. And then the neighbors phoned the press, and the press came around and said, well, you're the one that's doing all this stuff. And then it all leaked out. And then, of course, as I mentioned, I was sort of, wow, okay, I'll do the interview with CBC. And then I actually got a good report from in the newspapers on the military. Say, oh, he sounds like a real bright guy. Here I was causing all this panic in Vancouver, the UFO invasion that they thought was going on. And the headlines have said, Tom Swift at it again. And, of course, at that age, you know, I was, a big shot. You know, wow, look at this. I'm in the newspaper kind of attitude thing.
That's great. Let's go to the phones. East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. You're on with John Hutchison. Hi there.
It's Ralph from Winnipeg, Manitoba here.
Hi, Ralph.
I was wondering, John, I was wondering, have you ever heard of Jim Douglas out your way around Vancouver?
Hmm.
He teamed up with the retired head of Nuclear Energy Canada around 95, 96, and the last I heard, he was running this concept conversion organization, and they were planning on building two super huge Tesla coils. And then when they had that energy knockout around Toronto, Chicago area last year, from what I hear from some guys around Ottawa, or north of Ottawa, around Petawawa, and or a little town called Khartoum, there's two massive Tesla coils about 150 feet high underground. And they were started to test these about 3 to 4 days before that big blackout. And when they had the blackout, a lot of things happened around Petawawa there. I don't know if you're aware of this. And if you could get together with this Jim Douglas around Vancouver there through his son Gord, he might be able to help you out quite a bit.
That's kind of interesting. I know. I'm
very interesting. He used to be head of Rolls-Royce Jet Engines for about 18 years, too, and then he came over to Canada with, one of these big plastic companies to develop the plastic bag. And the guy's around 80 years old right now, but very sharp, very, very sharp.
Okay. I don't think I've heard of any of that. I know the blackout, of course, but I don't know of any research going in regards to those massive Tesla coils. They're pretty huge things.
When television gets involved with you, John, what are they looking for?
Stories about the Bermuda Triangle or anything mysterious like that, or ghosts, anything, because I tend to gravitate towards that stuff and was able to replicate it and can replicate it.
Tell me about the ghosts.
Oh, yeah, ghosts. Fascinating area. I just had an experience on the weekend going through the oldest mental hospital in British Columbia here and actually felt them, and I was with Corinne and Lee, who she's sort of a spiritual, both of them are quite spiritual and could feel the energies in that place. There's so much evil happened in the place.
Now, does this have anything to do with your Hutchison effect, or is this totally different?
This is totally different. I just simply go on these tangents where I want to investigate anything different or unusual. It can be ghosts. It can be odd energy things that are happening, like the Bermuda Triangle or the famous Booker Bay adventure. Anything different, unusual, paranormal, I want to check it out. And that's what I do.
So you are branching into something even bigger now?
Well, I've always been inclined to check into anything different. It's a challenge to me. I mean, when Bruce called about the Ark of the Covenant, I said, yes, yes, yes. And he said, well, what would you feel like if, okay, my part was Moses, he's Tut, and so on and so forth. What would you feel like a helicopter lowering you on Mount Sinai with the Ark? Would you do that? I said, yes, I would. It's the adventure and the challenge I like about that kind of stuff, George. If it's a haunted building and it's got horrible things in there and that, I'm right in there like a dirty shirt, carrying perhaps test equipment.
Tell me, I want your theory, John, of what you think ghosts are.
Trying to put it into a simple formulation here. I know there's other dimensions. I know that science is probing into subatomic sciences. What is a ghost? I think it's a spirit that's left behind somehow that didn't transform into that other world. I know it sounds kind of funny and not that scientific, but a lot of scientific activity has been measured at around 21 centimeters by Dr. Robert Jan at Princeton. There's so much stuff that happens, like clairvoyance and transmission of telepathy, which I've seen the government guys do it. And they talk about it like it's common stuff, like out-of-body experiences, things like that. To me, all this is new and fascinating, so I tend to lean in that direction. To give you the straight answer on a ghost, to give the formulation to it, I really don't know enough yet. I know that there's, and this is on official records, like I'm still on the SBIR program, it's the DOD's solicitation, and they talk about interdimensional stuff and zero-point energy like it's common to them.
Do you think these ghosts are in another dimension or another form of energy? What do you think they are?
I think so, George. I think they're in another dimension because I tapped into that accidentally during some of my experiments where all this colored light stuff descended around me. And it looked like entities running through it, but luckily I had the camera in my hand. It was still running, and it captured it. This happened a few other times where I'd walk towards a Tesla coil, just one Tesla coil in operation, and I'd walk towards it, and I would see this fog all around me. And I'd walk away from it, and the fog would disappear. Try and replicate it, I couldn't.
Have you been able to time travel because of what you have stumbled across? I mean, I'm almost looking at a Philadelphia-type experiment here.
It's been brought to my attention way back in 82 that it is similar to the Philadelphia experiment by certain scientists in New York. Instead of fine-tune the frequencies, then this would happen. We've had all kinds of weird things happen that, basically, luckily, Max Planck Institute can analyze metal samples that seem to be through a time distortion of some type.
Well, you haven't woken up in a different time warp somewhere, have you?
Well, I think, I don't know how to take that, George. I think maybe I was born that way, but no, I really haven't, although experienced a lot of unusual kind of things and feelings, but perhaps you can attribute that to something else, but...
Let's go to our first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, George. How's it going?
Good. Good.
Hey, Mr. Hutchinson, you had mentioned something about the Philadelphia experiment, and you were talking about earlier something about a building had almost like disappeared, become transparent. The only explanation I could think of is, when you think about Einstein's unified field theory, is that, you know, light, space, and time are all unified, and if you alter any one of those, you unwittingly alter the other two. And if you think about the Philadelphia experiment, I think basically they used a super-duper electromagnetic field through generators and created almost a vacuum almost and superheated the air. And I'm thinking somehow they went through some kind of space-time continuum that way. Is that kind of the feeling that you have of, like, how it's happening with your experiments? Like, how stuff is, like, metal is changing its composition to, like, almost a liquid form, stuff like that?
It's a good way of putting it. I mean, we've had bilocation where objects would disappear and reappear somewhere else, which is kind of strange. We haven't figured that one out yet. But in this area that you're talking about, it's just a vast sea of unknowns. We're still studying as much as we can about it.
Yeah.
All right, very good. Thank you for your call. Hey, your friends at the Fantastic Forum are say hello to you, by the way, John.
Oh, hi, guys. How you doing there?
They're out there. They're listening intensely to you. I'm getting a number of fast blasts about aluminum in magnetic fields, and they believe this may be crucial to some of the work you're doing. I don't quite understand it. Do you?
Well, I think they're referring to the old experiments they used to do in school where you have an aluminum plate, because I can't say aluminum properly, that is put on top of this coil and it shoots off in the air. It's a linear motor, and they're talking about Lorentz laws and eddy current set up in aluminum pieces, but this is not the case here because all the effects happen way far away from all the operating equipment, which is mostly RF and Tesla waves. There's no strong magnetic fields or anything like that. And to add to the soup here, all of this is within an electrostatic medium, all these fields that are operating from the RF operators, produce something else away from the machines themselves, because none of the RF fields could ever do this. And something else happens. Some matrix is formed. It's been brought to my attention by Andrea Sakharov and René Louis Vallée of France, who wrote up a report on this. Mostly Vallée did. And he tend to think that it was some type of basic displacement. But he puts in there a lot of equations, which I don't understand equations that well. I know my mathematics and measurements and all that, but when it comes to equations, I don't understand them.
Have you ever been hurt doing these experiments?
I had my arm actually caught in a field once.
What happened?
It felt like it was moved. How can I best describe it? Like if I had my arm within a whirling pool of mercury or something. It felt like a swirling sensation around my arm. But I was never hurt. And all the team members and scientists over the years were never hurt either. That's been brought up a few times in lectures and that. Has anybody?
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with John Hutchison. Hi there.
Hi there. Hi, George. This is Sean out in Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Hi, Sean.
And,
go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Sean.
Okay. I was just saying, before the break, Mr. Hutchison, you said the last name of a scientist, and I was just wondering, I caught the very end of it. Did you say Bedell?
Oh, no, that's a ex-congressman friend of mine, Berkeley Bedell. He's into alternative health.
And You're kidding me.
He's founded, he got his $30 million from Congress and founded the American Association for Alternative Health.
Wow, that's kind of weird because that's my last name as well, and I haven't heard, and as far as I know, there is nobody in my family that is involved at all like that, and that just really boggles my mind.
Just go do a Google search on Berkeley Bedell, and his name pops up in the American Association for Alternative Medicine.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much. And, George, your show is great. I'm a security guard out here in Colorado Springs, and I've been hooked on your shows ever since I started working here.
Well,
and
great.
That's
Thanks,
been
Sean.
For about 7 months now.
Appreciate
it. So I just want to say thank you for your show.
Okay, no problem. We're here for you. You know, John, is it conceivable that people who are in this kind of field eventually could get ill? I mean, like you were talking about your arm, but what about long-term effects? I mean, could something happen 5, 10, 15 years from now?
That's an interesting question. I don't look my age. I'm into actually life extension through the old Dirk Pearson method with added on research into phytonutrients and this kind of thing. And I sure don't show my age. I feel healthy. I'm like a kid most of the time. And none of us that have worked with it have ever had any complaints. George Hathaway, who was out here just a couple months ago for the book, he's in excellent health. No, I don't. Colonel Alexander, he's still in excellent health, and everybody else I know that has been involved is in great shape and doing very well.
If anything, I wonder if it might enhance your health.
That has been an interesting thought that I have had. Could it be? I don't know. I can't answer that. I know that Tesla had an electrotherapeutics company way back in the 1920s and 30s. It was a very popular thing back in that time for electrotherapeutics. Multiple wave oscillators and the violet ray to heal all types of diseases. There seems to be a bit of scientific fact to that with the rice therapies of long ago, where they'd find organisms and match them up to exact RF frequencies and then destroy the organisms without destroying, of course, the person themselves. I found myself, George, actually being addicted to the sparks. When I lost the lab there, I had a small Tesla coil that I turned on and just feel the energy from it, and I sort of felt good.
You liked it, huh?
I liked it. And I also did a TV show with Albert Budd in England, who brings up the topic of electromagnetism and allergies, actually, to electricity.
I believe that. I also believe it'll purify your blood, won't it?
Yes, although I would say the higher frequencies would, but the lower ones I think are dangerous.
Well, it's interesting to know that, because it's something that people shouldn't be playing around with unless they know what they're doing, huh?
For sure, George. Really.
Right. And you know, John, some of the things that you're working on could have medicinal effects as well. I mean, now I just had a story before you came on that they're using microwave technology for treating heart rhythm problems. They've been using ultrasounds to break up clogged arteries now. This could have some kind of an effect for us long term.
It sounds like it, George. I've been hearing they even use microwaves to heat up tumors, cancerous tumors, and destroy them too, without too much damage to the body. So I think all of this sort of is interconnected, all these different unique things.
Let's go back to the phones. Lots of people calling, want to chat with you, so let us go for it. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
So I want to ask the guest tonight, Mr. Hutchinson, about specifically about perpetual motion, the idea of perpetual motion, utilizing like pure magnetism or even gravity. And I just like James Cox, for instance, with his perpetual clock, which apparently worked, that was based on the notion of barometric pressure, which ultimately utilizes gravity, I guess you could see it that way. I'm wondering if you have done any experiments with perpetual motion in this area, with using magnetism or gravity, or just want to get your opinion on it, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yes, I guess I have done a lot of, not perpetual motion, but more or less collecting energy. One thing I like is reading about ham radio operators from the old times.
Mm-hmm.
And this is years ago. I hooked up a long wire antenna to the dead center of a tree, and it was about 50 feet of wire to it, and then I hooked it to a Tesla coil and capacitors. And I actually got a working voltage that ran some small motors. So history, again, it seems to have a lot of the stuff. There's a famous case with T. Henry Moray, who had these old vacuum tubes that he converted into transistors back in the 20s, where he was able to power, I believe it was 5,000 watts usable power. How he did it? Well, it was, again, long wire antennas. And now, of course, there's Dr. Franklin Mead's patent on the first, this is sort of a landmark case. It's a U.S. patent on a zero-point energy collector that uses barium titanate to collect the high-frequency electromagnetics or the zero-point energy quantum fluctuations, what are many names for it, and for it to use usable power. But it's very microscopic power, and being that the United States Patent Office accepted this in 1996, December 31, it was a landmark case. So, going into magnetics and that, I think with super magnets and superconductors, a lot of new things will come out on the scene with perpetual motion devices.
All right, thanks for that response. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, this is Marshall from Southern Pines, North Carolina.
Hi, Marshall. Go ahead.
Hey.
John, I'm curious to know, have you been able to build like a ship or something and move it from point A to point B anywhere on the planet or something like that?
Interesting question. That was the interest of McDonnell Douglas Aerospace Corporation, and it's also the interest of Lockheed Martin Skunk Works. However, myself, no, I'm still unfortunately landlocked.
I have one more question.
All right, go ahead.
Since your objects levitate here on Earth, would the reverse effect happen in space, or would it just bounce off gravitational fields in space?
Unknown. I think that, personally, what I feel that gravity is a product of material. They refer to them as gravitons or in conjunction with chronons, time particles. Because I studied a lot of stuff that was done in Germany from the DESI records on subatomic sciences, and I think that it's held somewhere, the secrets in the subatomic realm about a lot of these things.
Mm. Okay. Well, thank you.
You're
right,
welcome.
Thank you. How did you get a 7-Up bottle to float?
Oh, that was one of our test samples. We were running out of test samples, George. So we raided the lab refrigerator and threw a 7-Up bottle in there, and then we put ice cream in there and everything you can think of except the kitchen sink. Well, we did put a white bucket in there, and it took off.
I was wondering how you did that or why you did that. Of everything you could test, there's a 7-Up bottle there.
I think it's a good reference point scientifically because it is a 7-Up bottle. It's not a fake thing or some kind of weird stuff that somebody would argue against. That was some of the things that used common articles.
Well, that's true. Good point. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I had an interesting thing happen to me when I put in livestock wire fencing around my acre and a quarter, and I kind of cut it in half in the middle where my driveway goes into the property. And what happened was, it was like winter, and not quite cold winter, but pretty good. And when it was put in, it went, you know, all around the whole property. And then during the season when we put out our Christmas lights, I put out my Christmas lights, like those rope lights, and ran it through the wiring as, you know, the wiring on the fence, the small square wiring. It's probably not more than 6 inches square for 4 feet to the ground. And what happened was my power bill just dropped immensely. And you don't have that happen in Montana in the winter. Do you have some kind of explanation to me that I could understand?
That sounds like an investigation. That sounds really cool. No, not right now. I'd have to think, roll that around in my mind a bit. But maybe you stumbled upon a ground system, or maybe the fence itself was picking up some electrical energy and helping your power be reduced. I know,
like power in the road would do that underground.
Probably yes. If let's say you have a fence like that and it causes what they call induction, you can get a bit of energy from it.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Lots of strange things going on this planet.
I know, George.
Wild card line. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
I think we all need to find out what their last caller was doing. Hey, everybody. This is John in Atlanta. Good morning, guys.
Hi, Jim.
Hi.
John, I was wondering if you were familiar with Tim Reifert's work.
I don't think I am, unless I'm a very, you know, it comes to names, I kind of forget who people are, and when I meet them, I forget their names, so I have that bit of a problem there.
He's an author and researcher. He's wrote a book on remote viewing. He's English, and he's done a lot of research into the Soviet Union's psychotronic psychic warfare program. And he might be a great guest for you, too, George. He goes into how the Russians were using Tesla coils to enhance their psychic ability, and also, I believe, to somehow block other remote viewers from viewing what they were doing. And George, in his book, he talks about how the Russians were spending hundreds of millions of dollars back in the early 80s on their psychic warfare program. And it's quite amazing, far, far more than what we were spending.
Oh, I believe that, yeah.
Yeah, I do, too. I remember the famous Soviet woodpecker signals that were hammering away at the ham bands. back in the late 70s and early 80s. A lot of stuff that about also psychotronics that I know most of the people involved in the psychotronic stuff.
John, are you familiar with the Heart Project up there in Alaska?
Oh, yeah. My, I call her my sister, Jean Manning, who wrote a book on alternative energy, exposed the whole thing and got all of that out. And Nick Baggage also was involved.
Yes.
And she wrote a book called Angels Don't Play This Harp. And actually, she dropped off one of the manuals for the project. And I'm very familiar with the project and what it can do and the dangers of it also.
Did she write that with Nick? She must have. I just think of him with that book primarily, but I guess they're equal.
Oh, they're equal. Yeah, she wrote the book, and he dictated to her, and she did a lot of investigation. And actually, as I mentioned before, she dropped a handbook on the Heart Project. And there's other people that have concerns about it, because you can reverse the polarity of the ionosphere and have radio transmissions around the Earth. Also, there's a danger that if you go right through the ionosphere into the Van Allen belt, you could cause a Ben Franklin effect.
What is the Ben Franklin effect?
Well, of course, that's the kite experiment where the lightning comes down and fills up Leyden jars. But in this particular case, the beams could follow from the Van Allen belts down to the Earth and stall the Earth's geomagnetic field. That was written up by Dr. Junerman in R&D Innovator magazine. And I thought it was quite an interesting...
All right, what would happen if that happened?
Oh, there would be all types of cyclone force winds. The outer shell of the Earth would start spinning around, basically causing climatic changes on a very dramatic level, earthquakes, all kinds of horrific stuff.
Okay, let's go to our international line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi there.
Yeah,
I'm a bit nervous. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
I saw, I believe it was either on CNN or another very reputable news source. I was on TV, and some people have this very rare ability, but it's not unknown. It's sort of like a magnetic ability. And they show this Asian man who he could take an iron that you would use to iron clothing, and it could just stick to his chest. And his son also has this ability to just stick to metal objects. And when they take a magnetic, you know, those devices they use to gauge magnetic fields, and these devices don't show that they have any magnetic fields surrounding them, but yet they seem to be sticking to metal. And I was just thinking that maybe that man who built the Coral Castle had this ability. And maybe he used it maybe in conjunction with something else. And just a thought on magnetic, the mysteries of magnetics and gravity. And
Very interesting question, because the body has nucleic acids, which are slightly magnetic, and they're hypersensitive to the Earth's geomagnetic field. What if somebody was able to enhance that effect many times over and actually were to add... manipulate matter, like you're saying. There's a very interesting model, actually, a friend of mine who, again, with McDonnell Douglas, Jack Houck, has a very unique model of a lot of this stuff on a website he has put up. I guess you'd have to Google search it, George Jack Houck.
But, how does he spell his last name, Jim?
H-O-U-C-K.
Okay.
And that's Jack Houck.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with John Hutchison. Hi there.
Hi. This is Dan.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, John. How
Cleveland,
you doing?
Right? Yeah.
Hey, this is Dan. You remember me? We've been working on a screenplay about your life story.
Yes, I remember you, Dan, and plus a few others there that are working on it.
yeah, my screenplay, The Effect. And I want to thank you for allowing me to sit down and talk to you and interview you about your life story and your whole work.
Well, I was wondering how that's going, because I have had many film people around trying to do with my life story, and the last being Miramax, but then that sort of collapsed. But
I have been getting a lot of response from different actors, like Virginia Hay or Mark Singer. He wanted to play you.
Mm-hmm.
And Don Corley. From the Planet of the Apes. He wanted to play Mel Winfield.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's the kind of response I've been getting actors and people around the country interested in the screenplay called The Effect.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a very interesting life story because you started out with agoraphobia and you were sent to a hospital for a while back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm, that's true. Or actually the 60s.
Yeah, and you shot a cannon off in the hospital scaring all the patients.
Exactly.
Wait a minute. What did you do?
I took a cannon and shot it off in the hospital.
How did you get a cannon in there?
Oh, that was easy. I mean, I was sort of left on my own in that place. And that experience is yet another story, and I wouldn't trade that experience for all the tea in China. It taught me a lot about humanity. And
you wheeled a cannon into a hospital?
Well, let's say it's not that big of a cannon, George. It was a brass cannon, maybe a foot long.
Oh, I'm thinking of the Civil War things.
Well, I had those too, but no, I sold those, but I did fire off a cannon with toilet paper.
Well, that's right. You were a collector, right?
Oh, I'm a prolific collector of those things. I actually got quite a collection now. But no, I actually fired off a cannon in the hospital.
Well, that's interesting. You've got another possible screenplay out there. You've got a lot of potential out there.
A lot of people seem to be interested in my story.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello. I hope you two are having a nice night tonight.
Yes, we are.
Oh, for sure.
John, I've got a question for you, and this is it. You mentioned your sensitivity to electronic fills and to ghosts, and my question is, since your experiments are not always easily reproducible when you were not there, do you feel like your own consciousness may affect the results that you're getting?
That is a very good question. It's been brought up a lot of times in the military-industrial complex, and tests were done with me not present. I can only say that I don't want to sound like a bragging idiot here, but I feel that understanding old machinery, I was able to really fine-tune it. Like you would run a lathe, you'd have a good machinist and a poor machinist, and I just felt that my talents with the old stuff was, well, good. But however, the other team that worked with Boeing were able to replicate the effects with this 1,500-pound transformer, so without me knowing about it. And I'm still friends with one of the fellows, Alec, and we're actually talking about that just the other day. And we have what we call the annual levitator party thing. I'm talking about the good old days when we did all the experiments, so it's been done without me present. And the PK thing is, again, I keep saying it's, I believe, a whitewash effect from the government, although the Canadian government don't go into saying it's PK.
Do you believe in UFOs, John?
Oh, yeah, of course. My ex, a filmmaker, she made a movie, three-part TV miniseries. And I've always felt there was something out in deep space. This is some time ago, back in 91. I just simply went and phoned the CIA and got all these reports in, investigated all the stuff, and I feel there are UFOs around, for sure.
Do you believe this could be the technology, electromagnetic technology, anti-gravity?
It has to be. That's the only way to do anything. It's the only way to manipulate time and space and propulsion.
How would they create velocity with this?
I think by manipulating the subatomic realm where all this happens. They already have surpassed the speed of light. I think it's 300 times in Austria. In Austria, they did experiments. And also, they're doing experiments where they're actually teleporting a few atoms at a time. So I think that going into hyper-propulsion, you can shield yourself. You can go many multiples of speed of light with the technology. Right now, it's in a very crude form, like computers, let's say, back in the 50s were. So to advance it, you'd need a large team to go right into it right now and start to work on it.
It could be done.
It could be done, yes. Something 5 years from now.
John, we haven't touched too much on the transparency of the metal samples under your Hutchison effect. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the transparency, George, was brought to my attention by the Canadian government when they analyzed the Super 8 mm film from long ago. they noticed that these metal blocks seemed to be transparent, where you could actually see through them and see what was underneath them. Now, I have never seen this, but it's written up by Dr. Kuhn of the Director of Scientific Technical Intelligence Agency in Ottawa, Canada. And, however, it's confirmed in some ways also by the Max Planck Institute, where they found that certain parts of certain samples seem to have a certain transparency to them, which these, a lot of these samples have been under a lot of different tests with impossible alloys that they can't even match up on anything on, well, from what the reports say, anything on Earth anyhow, with these samples. So a lot of
that's got to be bizarre, to be able to look at a piece of metal and to be able to see through it.
Oh, I think it's really special. If only I have to see it myself. A lot of the stuff that's reported, I never get to see it sometimes.
Is that on? Is any samples or pictures on your website with this?
The transparency effect, no. I think it basically is held within the tapes that my colleague George has.
Okay. We've got the gelification. That's on your website.
Yes, gelification, okay, and levitations and other effects, for sure.
All right. Let us go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on with John Hutchison. Hi there.
Hi. Hi, John. I have a question for you. I was wondering if you knew anything about that battery that was found in one of the pyramids.
Oh, cool stuff. Yeah, love it right away. It often referred to as the Baghdad battery, too. It's basically a clay vessel with a little piece of copper in it and an iron bar. And you put vinegar in it, and you got yourself a power source. That's basically how those things worked. And it's interesting that they had them in those days.
Wow, I had no idea that they had those in those days.
Yes, actually, they tested one by putting vinegar in it, and they got voltage out of it. But they're most likely, in the speculation, is that they were used for some of the electroplating.
Oh, okay.
Done 3,000 years ago.
Yeah, 3,000 years ago. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
Well, I think they had technology way before that, too.
Yeah, I do, too.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
This ancient technology that we both believe, John, was out there, what do you think ever happened to it?
I think it just somehow something happened on Earth here, whether it was a meteorite or something, because in museums around the world they have uncategorized artifacts, like stainless steel bars with thousands of years of dirt around them that's actually crystallized or turned into rock. And they can't categorize this stuff, and they just let it sit in some of these museums. That's what I am told. So, long time ago, something might have happened on Earth and just wiped out life, or who knows? History is such a mystery in trying to find the facts. Like working with the Ark of the Covenant took a lot of research from all different points of religion to find out.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
It was quite a project. We're running back and forth the library, looking in all different books on different views, and found basically that every country seems to have some type of ark. But the ark was quite the thing to research out.
Tell me about American Anti-Gravity, that organization. You're part of that. They host your homepage.
That's right, yes. Tim Ventura, they're doing lifter technology, and that's, again, very light, triangular-shaped aluminium machines there with a high voltage attached to it, and when they apply the high voltage, these things go flying in the air. And they're actually doing some very interesting research in the areas of anti-gravity, and I'm highly impressed. And I haven't built, believe it or not, I haven't built my own lifter except that saucer thing with the high voltage wire to it.
So, see, I don't know with you being at the forefront of this, why you haven't made some incredible machines with this, John.
Well, we did a lot of testing in that, and there was speculation that, again, that it would require mega money to make an actual flying craft, according to McDonnell Douglas and certain other organizations.
If you were told to stop because they threatened you for whatever reason, would you tell us that tonight?
Exactly. Of course I would, right away.
Okay.
My thing is I always call in the media when something happens. Like the famous balcony incident, I called in the press right away, and sure enough, we covered the story. And
What was the famous balcony incident?
Oh, actually, it was Art Bell there posted the balcony on his webcam. It's basically people complaining about all my antennas and stuff on the balcony in my antenna.
Oh, I heard about that. Okay, that's what that was. Okay.
Yeah, that's my approach to being threatened. I go right being very offensive with media.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes. Hello, George. Hello, John.
Hi.
Good
Hi.
To speak with you. Now, this may sound silly, but in lieu of John's abilities, and I'm sure I'm not I doubt I'm the first person to mention this. You sound like a real life Magneto. I mean, I'm not.
He's Magneto Man.
Magneto Man.
from the X-Men, and he was a mutant. His genetics were set up in such a way that he could manipulate various metals and their electromagnetic frequencies in the field.
I wonder if that's why I get all the strange looks once in a while.
Magneto Man.
Magneto Man at your service.
Are you wearing some special uniform or costume or anything like that?
Oh, don't press the issue, George. I know Gene Manning pressed the issue for me to walk around New Westminster here with night vision on. I mean, we did it. She dared me. I do it.
Wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, you are on.
Oh, aloha from aloha. Hawaii. I'm calling from KHVH, listening to you late at night.
Well, good to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm curious to know if your guest knows about Art's antennas and if he has any predictions on outcomes of what's going to, you know, come out of them.
If Art's antennas, John, get any higher, he's going to be touching the bottom of the International Space Station.
I think so. I love what he's doing. He's on the right track. I always refer to him in some of my emails and that Art Bell has discovered this energy source. And when I was talking to Art about that, and it's around about 400 volts with a small little ripple of AC on it. And he discovered all this thing through history himself, too. Reading about a ham radio operator doing these unique things with antennas, and he duplicated it, and there you have a potential energy source. All my power to the Art there.
Let's go to our international line. You are on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, good afternoon, George. Mr.
Sure
Epstein,
thing.
A pleasure. Yet, I feel like I'm going through deja vu. This is fascinating. I don't know if you're familiar with a gentleman named Mel E. Winfield, also from Vancouver, but he's doing the identical research to what you're doing. Everything you've mentioned, I've been talking to Mel about.
Well,
in fact, he launched a small ball bearing through the ceiling of his house accidentally.
I do know Mel, and I don't want to go there because that was sort of a dispute with the Ferris Technologies Group.
Uh-huh.
Because he misrepresented the pictures and photographs.
Yours or of his work?
Of all my work, and got a free ride out to Toronto where he presented it.
I've seen him do the exact work.
Well,
in person.
My philosophy, if you've seen it, get the media on it, and they'll cover it. That's what I do.
Okay, John. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate your call. I know you don't want to dwell on this, but what happened? Somebody plagiarized you?
Oh, yes. That happened a long time ago, and, it upset Mr. Pizarro and my colleague Hathaway and some other people. Because they were starting to use phone calls and manipulation back then, and we compared we taped the phone calls and compared them all, found it was the same person. Anyway, that's a long story, George.
Yeah, those things happen.
I know. But on to better things.
Hey, Paul Allen from Microsoft has invested $15 to $20 million in the SETI for this Allen Telescope Array, and they've got a series of radio telescopes now. That uses a lot of energy as well. Any tie-ins with some of the things you do?
Oh, I love radio astronomy. I have radio astronomy spectrum analyzers here that scan for stuff out in space. And I'll turn these things on, and I pick up weird signals coming in.
Yeah. Who's on East? Let's do that. We're running out of time here. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
This is Dean.
Hello, Dean. Where are you?
I'm in Chicago right now.
Well, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Boy, I've been trying to get on forever. I'm outside in my car so I don't disturb my wife. Yeah. Listen, here's
we don't want to do that.
I've been dying to talk to you. Like this one guy said, you're never condescending and you never talk down to anybody and you always listen like you're interested in what they're saying. And I really respect that in a person because I try to be that way. And I really appreciate the show. I've been listening for about a month now, and I just can't go to sleep.
Well, I'm glad. How did you find us?
Well, I got you on WLS, which is a popular station, but they stopped the program at 2. So I went out to the car, and I was going click by click on the radio, and I got you in from a station in Cleveland.
WTAM. There's a monster
TAM,
station
right
there, too.
And I'm listening to you right now in Chicago on a station in Cleveland. It's funny. But anyway, what I'm an avid UFO guy, and I record every show, and then I'll take the clips that they show the flying saucers and, put them on another tape. And there was one particular clip about when there was an eclipse in Mexico, and everybody was looking up at the eclipse, and they got this ship in up above, way off. And I did it on at a fast speed so I could see the... And frame by frame, you can see the top and the bottom of the ship is like growing and shrinking and growing and shrinking. And the rest of the ship doesn't change. And you can see this like plasma gas around it if you look. You got to have a good machine. But you could see the gas. It's like, like I've heard other callers talk about this plasma or whatever that surrounds it. But the bottom and the top, this was like a, typical saucer shape with a, like a pie pan. And on the top and the bottom, it was rather large, like a protrusion, up and down, like a hub on either side. And they went up and down, and I watched it over and over again. And there's a couple of other clips that have the same characteristic with this pulsing, but they're further off and they're not as clear. But this one, it's the Mexico City, it was from a news video.
I remember that one.
Yeah,
that was a fantastic one.
It really is. And I'm listening to this guy, and a lot of your stuff, I'm not interested too much in that spiritual. I mean, it's interesting, but I don't pay attention like this UFO stuff because there's something going on and, nobody wants to talk about it. And I'm sure there's good reasons, but gosh, tonight I saw something up in the sky, two little red lights, and it was way too far away to be a plane because it was going really fast. And then it kind of turned, and then it just disappeared behind the roof. It's like it just dove down or something. I tried to, with binoculars out here at like 1 in the morning, but I couldn't see it again. So, but I'm always looking. But that thing, and I'm just wondering if this electromagnetism, that Bob Lazar guy?
Yep.
Yeah, well, I really, the video that they made of him going through the ship, and they don't show it very often, and that's a great video. It's a computer animation of what the ship looks like in like a three-dimensional. You saw that, right?
Oh, yeah. You are excited about this field.
Oh, God,
I can tell. I can tell. That's exciting.
It's really fascinating.
That's good.
You know, John, would you ever take a trip in a UFO if they came down and got you?
Oh, don't tempt me, George. I sure would. Without hesitation.
I would do that, too.
Without hesitation, I'd do it.
Even if the name of the ship was called To Serve Man? You remember that?
Yes, I remember that. Now that ship I'd have second thought about, but that was a good Twilight film.
Wild Card Line, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
I had a question for John on geomagnetics. Could the geomagnetic field be affected by this device? I'm not understanding exactly how the machine is put together.
Interesting.
Where the field would occur.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a geology student studying geomagnetics and how they are sometimes precursors to larger geologic events like earthquakes. I was wondering if this field could affect in some way the tensional forces within the Earth's crust.
That's an interesting question. What do you think, John?
Very valid question, too. I would imagine it could affect on a larger scale the stresses within the Earth. There's speculation that Tesla caused the famous explosion in 1908 in
Tunguska?
Tunguska.
Over Siberia, yeah.
Yeah, but the speculation there that he'd created that.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah, that was some of the stuff that's going around that people talk about. Although I
always assumed it was an airburst from a meteorite.
Personally, that's how I would think that
yeah,
it would
be. And that's the general acceptance. But you're right, John. There was talk that maybe he did something, and it beamed over there and did it.
Mm-hmm. That's, of course, speculation.
Wild. So this actually causes what, a wrinkle in the space-time fabric?
We believe it does. There's a lot of documentation on that aspect of it, because it can't be RF. Radio transmitters and Tesla coils can't do it, but it opens up a doorway into another dimension is what we feel it does.
Speaking of doorways, John, we're going to have to go through one now because the program is almost coming to an end.
Okay.
Do you want to direct people to the website at all? Is there anything material that you'd like people to take a look at?
Oh, sure. Some video stock at Rumor Mill News or at the anti-gravity site, American Anti-Gravity. My friend Tim Ventura there, he's promoting some of my videos and stuff like that.
And what's next for you? Television shows on the horizon again?
Yeah, more of another Bermuda Triangle show. It's for
that
National Geographic one this time. So,
as a matter of fact, somebody just sent me an email while we were talking to you. They already saw you on television tonight, so you're everywhere.
Oh, I'm all over the place. They're plastered me.
All right, great. John, thanks. I appreciate you being on Coast to Coast.
It's been a lot of fun, George, and all my best to you. Keep up the great work.
You too.